Wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's John Otter's sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's John Otter's sunglasses. If he's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio, and it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this May 27th Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick interviews Mark Brenner on the manufactured PERS crisis and the larger real crisis of pensions, which most Americans having little more than Social Security when they retire. Mark Brenner was director of labor notes for 12 years. He is currently working at the University of Oregon's Labor and Education Research Center, and we're happy to have him here in Oregon to help us with this fight. In the second half of our program, Book Mole Larry Bolden reviews Chumpa Lahiri's newest novel, The Lowland. And to end our program this morning, Desiree Heliger's interviews Ophelia Noble. She's the founder and executive director of the Vancouver-based Noble Foundation and an organizer with Southwest Washington Communities United for Change. They discuss Vancouver's police department's escalating use of lethal force against people of color over the last few months. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting KBOO and programs like the Old Mole. And remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and Mark Brenner.
Mark Brenner, welcome to KBOO.
Oh, thanks for having me, Bill. Great to be here.
Mark Brenner, for 11 years, directed the organization Labor Notes. It publishes the journal Labor Notes. Their aim, the organization's aim and Labor Notes' aim, is to democratize labor, to build rank-and-file consciousness and power, and in general, to put the movement back into that labor movement. While at Labor Notes, he wrote many articles and co-wrote the book, Secrets of a Successful Organizer, among other books. He's now with the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon here in Portland. Earlier this week, he made a presentation and led a discussion about PERS, the public employee retirement system that's been under vicious, sustained attack from conservative business and interests and the Oregonian newspaper. Mark, tell us about PERS and the current struggles.
Sure. PERS was established in the mid-40s, right after World War II, and it's been a functioning and very healthy retirement system for public employees in the state of Oregon ever since. What's interesting about PERS is it's really kind of the subject of the biggest lie that you've ever seen in the newspaper here in the state of Oregon. And just like all big lies, if you repeat it enough, people begin to believe it. And the big lie that's told about PERS is that PERS is going bankrupt, that PERS is in crisis, that we have to act, that there's no alternative than to do something about PERS. But when you actually look at the facts, it's all upside down. PERS is not going bankrupt. In fact, PERS has over $66 billion in the bank. And just to give you some perspective, the amount of money that they paid out to retirees last year was about $5 billion. So you tell me, when we've got $66 billion in the bank and it's earning 10.5% interest in the last 5 years, how are we going bankrupt? We're not.
Even if it was earning 5% interest, maybe what the future is going to be with all this money competing for more. But even at 5%, and in fact, the amount paid is going down because PERS was reformed not long ago to really change the system a lot.
Right. This is one of the things that's so frustrating about it. Just to return to the question of PERS health, up until the financial collapse in 2008, HERS was what the accountants would call fully funded. In other words, if we estimate, well, how much are we going to have to pay out in benefits far into the future for people who are in the system today working as active public employees when they retire, you know, 20 years from now, we had enough money in the bank today to cover what we think all of those obligations in the future would be. That was true up until the 2008 financial collapse. Since then, we've gone up and down, but we were about 80% funded is the accounting term for it. And when we compare PERS in Oregon with states around the country, we're actually quite well off. I mean, a friend of mine was telling me that we're number 17 out of 50 states. So if we're doing so well relative to our peers, why is it in the news? You know, why are we talking about this? And more what frustrates people who care about facts so much, Bill, is exactly what you said. The problems that ever did exist in PERS, we dealt with long ago. In 1997, we created Tier 2, and then very shortly thereafter, in 2003, we created Tier 3.
Tier 2 and 3, right. The old PERS system is gone and forever, probably, which was fairly generous. Not that generous, but for a few people, like Mike Bellotti, University of Oregon's football coach, he's getting a couple $1 million a year from PERS because of the formula for paying.
That's right.
A big mistake.
That's right. But they fixed over 20 years ago.
That was fixed, but they fixed it in ways now that people coming into the system have a much, much less decent retirement system than in the past.
Right. Like, I'll just use myself as an example. I'm a Tier 3 PERS contributor. Assuming that I can vest in PERS, I'm not vested yet. I just started the U of O this year, so it's going to take 5 years before I'm vested, which means before I'm eligible to collect a pension. And if I work for 20 years, I'll get about a third of my final average salary. That'll be what I'll get. Most people today in PERS, just to give people a sense of the largesse of PERS, the average annual benefit is about $30,000, $31,000.
$1,000. The average. And what about the mean?
The median is $24,000. So 65% of people who get PERS are getting less than $36,000. People are not getting rich off of PERS. In fact, only 7% of PERS recipients make more than $72,000. So when people talk about Mike Bellotti, yes, he's making a lot of money off the PERS system.
Well, he was a football coach.
And he was the football
That's
coach.
That's really important.
U of O football,
Ten
as I've learned, is really important. I think he probably was more popular than the governor when he was the football coach.
More popular, yes.
So in any event, all of the things that allowed those kinds of spiking of salaries and stuff were corrected over 15 years ago with the creation – well, 20 years ago with the creation of Tier 2 and then 15 years ago with the creation of Tier 3. Yeah. So really what's frustrating about this debate in the State House and in the media right now is that the PERS system is sustainable as we've constructed it. The problem is it's going to take some time for whatever overreach we might have had with Tier 1 to work its way out of the system. But that's not really why we're under fire. You know this, and I know this.
No, it's another story, and let's get into that. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Mark Brenner recently of Labor Notes. He directed the organization, wrote a lot for it, for its journal, Labor Notes. Recently left, still works with them. Now he's teaching at the Labor Education and Research Center, and you're in the Portland office teaching and various kinds of training work, right? Are you going to be teaching courses, actually, in the courses for undergraduates?
No, we teach primarily working adults, union members, and community members. It's one of the few programs that the U of O runs that actually is aimed at the general public. Mm-hmm. And the U of O, unfortunately, is constantly trying to trim its public mission and public service. But we're fighting that, too.
We've been talking about the attack on the public employment retirement system, how frustrating it is. It's sustained by the Oregonian and many other forces, Oregon Business Council. But what's the story on that? Why are they doing it? It's part of a larger picture, too. This is not just an attack on PERS. It's part of the attack on working people and the extraction of wealth from from the society.
There's two reasons PERS is in the news right now. One is very real, and the other is completely political, as you described. The very real reason that PERS is in the news right now is because of the financial collapse, as I mentioned before. The amount of money we have in the bank in our PERS fund is not, according to our best counting projections, is not sufficient to pay benefits for all of our future retirees. We're about 80% of what we need to have to cover our future obligations. Now, keep in mind, these are projections that go 30, 40, 50 years out into the future. They are based on all kinds of assumptions. So it's pretty shaky math on its own, but this is what accountants do. So because we don't have enough money in the bank, according to our accountants, to pay all the future retirees, we have what they call an unfunded liability, and we've got to try and pay that down. The PERS board has committed itself to pay down this unfunded liability over the next 20 years. And so to do that, they're charging PERS employers, like the University of Oregon, like the Portland Public School District, more money per employee. It used to be that employers would contribute about 10-11% of payroll to PERS, and now those rates have risen up to 25%. And that's a very real thing that school districts and cities and towns are confronting. So that's why it's in the news. You know, that's one of the reasons it's in the news. And that's a very real problem, but it's a very easy to fix problem, right? We have taken it upon ourselves to try and quote unquote pay down this unfunded liability over 20 years. Most cities and states pay it down over 30 years. In fact, there's some that pay it over 40. This is a debt we owe ourselves. It's not a debt we owe Wells Fargo or any financial institution. This is something that we could easily do. And if we change the horizon, just to give you a for instance, if we change the horizon from 20 years to 30 years, it would add 4% more to the Portland Public School budget. It would add 4% more to the, on average, to the city of Portland. So what would you do with 4% more money in the city budget?
This is all accounting stuff.
Exactly. These are the, and as we know, accounting, you know, lies, damn lies, and statistics sometimes is what comes to mind here. I want to say that about accounting, that the rules, who writes the rules for accounting? You know, they're usually written in business schools, and they're often subtly
they're
very
jiggered.
Political.
They're yeah. triggered according to who's in political power. There's just no question about that. There are easy solutions, too.
That's right.
You just tax the rich a little bit. There's so much money out there.
Yeah, there's plenty of money in the Oregon economy. It's just in the wrong pockets. The issue that you're getting at, Bill, that I know you really want to talk about, is that this is not an accident. The fact that these things are happening, it's not a technical issue. It's not about, oh, what's the employer rate for Portland Public Schools in contributing to PERS? How much do they have to put into PERS? That's not why we're having this fight. We're having this fight because for the last three decades, there's been a sustained effort on the part of corporations and the super rich in this country to destroy whatever social welfare systems we've built, whatever safety nets we've built, whatever collective security our country has built. And PERS is under fire because corporations and the super rich want to destroy defined benefit pensions and replace them with 401ks. And it really is moving from a system of we're all in this together to a system of you're on your own. That's what they want. They want us to be on our own with zero security, with zero obligation to each other.
And to demolish unions, of course, because unions represent poor people as badly as they do often. They do represent the working classes, at least in their industries, and often the working classes because they support Social Security for everybody.
At their heart, Bill, unions are about collective solutions to collective problems. Like, we have problems as a society. We have problems as a group of employees at our workplace. We want to come up with collective solutions to those problems, and that's exactly what a pension is. A pension is a collective solution to a collective problem. We all need security in retirement. So how do we make sure that we have something we can count on? You know, for those who don't have one, a defined benefit pension is a really great thing. You're guaranteed after working a certain number of years that for the rest of your living days, you're going to have a check coming to you every month that you can count on. It's going to be $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, whatever it might be, in many cases far less than that, unfortunately, but you can count on that. That's not what they want. They want all the risk of, you know, the vagaries in the financial market and whatnot to be on your shoulders.
Yeah. Well, they also just want the money. I mean, to some extent, they built an industry. There is now a huge industry in this country that systematically tries to extract from the whole economy and working people the wealth that was going in that direction and move it to the rich. And they do it through legislation and numerous things. Accounting rules explain that. It's not as if you could ask the rich, aren't you rich enough now? Can't you afford a 2% tax on your wealth? I mean, it just keeps growing.
I don't know what Tim Boyle would say, but you should get him on your show and ask, aren't you rich enough?
Someone will say that. But regardless of what the 1% would think,
they're happy to do it on their own terms. Student Success Act is a fair demonstration of that. If we want to negotiate with corporations, they'll give us some tiny slice of what they've got. But I think, as you're pointing out, we need far more than that, and we deserve far more than that. And part of the problem is, for so long, we've been lowering our expectations about what we as regular, everyday working people deserve and what our government can actually provide for us. And I think it's no small part of this that for so many years, starting with Ronald Reagan, as you recall, famously saying, you know, the scariest words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. You know, demonizing the idea that government can improve your life, demonizing the idea that we can build programs that will actually provide the kind of collective security that we need, whether it be around housing or education or retirement, that we can't do those. I mean, you know, we went from an era where we would aim to send a man to the moon, and now we're like, oh, we have to let people die in the streets because we can't do anything about it.
You know, the irony of that is, of course, of that extraction from the working class and efforts to destroy the state and unions and the state that puts some limits on rich people's predation. The irony is that it's going to destroy the very basis of their wealth, ultimately, if they continue this.
Well, and I think that's why some people are willing to make some small concessions, Bill.
Small concessions, right. No, the interesting thing is that, in fact, the state is, one can look at sort of the United States today and see that it's, in fact, the public investments that they always resisted, of course, because they're done by the state, are the very basis of its prosperity. I mean, if you look at the United States, your university is a land-grant college, right?
Actually, OSU is a land-grant college. We're not. But
OSU, but there's a lot of land-grant colleges.
Absolutely.
That is set up by the state. The U.S.
U of O is a public university,
by the
absolutely.
National state.
Although they're trying to privatize it.
Right, they're trying to privatize, yes. And the research done there is the research and the technical research, not just the basic research, but the technical research, all of which gets taken over by private industry.
Sure. If you go to the interstate highway system, you know, the internet, all of that was based on public investment. Everything that makes...
And the computer industry, the electronics industry. The U.S. is preeminent in the world economy because of state investments.
Absolutely, Bill.
Such an irony. They're trying to destroy this whole apparatus. People don't understand, I think, that the U.S. has this immense research apparatus in comparison to almost any other country. The U.S. research apparatus, funded by the state, not by the companies claim they have research departments. Well, they do. The research department takes sort of innovation out of the public sector and monetizes it.
Well, so here's what I'll say, Bill. I mean, what's interesting to me about this is when you look at what's happening with PERS here in Oregon, it's part of a much bigger attack on the very basic sort of security and safety net that we built in this country after World War II. Look at the ways people have been trying to attack Social Security, coming after Medicare. And I think what we're seeing now is we're really going to go in one of two directions. Particularly for folks who are in public pension systems or even pensions in private corporations. You know, it's very hard to be an island of security in a sea of insecurity. Half the people in the country have no retirement whatsoever, and less than 15% of the population is in a defined benefit pension.
There's an enormous crisis of old age impending, where there's going to be huge numbers of people who live on nothing but Social Security payments and some who don't qualify for Social Security, and God knows how they're going to live. This is like over, 50 or 60 or 70 or 80% of the people who are approaching 75 years old have nothing.
Yeah, they did a study at the Center for Retirement Research at Boston University and found that, first off, as I said before, half of the population, and particularly half of people close to retirement, 55 to 65, have no retirement plan whatsoever. They don't have a 401k. They don't have anything that, like you said, that all they've got to count on is Social Security. But then of the people who had a 401k who are 10 years away from retirement, the average balance in their 401k is about $150,000. So you can't retire and live for 20 years after retirement.
No, you can 3 or 4 years and exhaust it, and then you can go on.
Back to work? I don't know.
Back to work or on the street, or you live in your car.
Well, and I think that's really what we're faced with.
Or you move in with some relative for a while until the welcome mat is taken away.
I'm coming to live with you, Bill. That's my plan.
You do lawns?
For housing, absolutely. Yeah, right. But I think what you're pointing to is the fact that all of the things that are happening, you know, this attack on PERS, which is, you know, mirrors an attack on Social Security at the federal level, an effort to try and privatize these things and put them in the hands of the financial analysts and the Wall Street deal makers. It is really driving us into an older era. As you said, like it didn't used to be that people could live independently in their retirement because they didn't have any money.
Well,
they had to live with their children.
They used to also die at age 60.
Well, I'm not rooting for that outcome, but what I do think we want is we are the richest country in human history. So why is it that we are looking to what were, you know, standards of living 100 years ago for people in retirement? You know, retirement didn't really exist until, you know, many of the gains that the union movement made. And I think that the way forward, which is really what I think all of us who are active in the labor movement should be thinking about, all of us who are progressives should be thinking about. And it's not about, I mean, yes, part of it is defending things like PERS because this is just a ginned up attack, a ginned up crisis, which we need to resist. But we also need to think forward. Like, why aren't we expanding PERS to be a state pension system for every employer in the state of Oregon? Yeah. Why aren't we thinking about solutions to these problems that go well beyond, you know, our current state of play? We need to go on offense and stop playing defense.
I agree. Let's talk about the politics. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour talking to Mark Brenner. Once of Labor Notes, wrote a lot for them for 11 years, then left the organization, come to Oregon and work at the Labor Education and Research Center. We've been talking about the attack on PERS, part of an attack on all, in fact, working class income and power that's been going on for quite some time, sort of known as neoliberalism. It's the old system, except that now they have achieved political power.
It's meaner.
Meaner, yes. One of the great problems, and you referenced it, they've managed to get rid of defined benefit pensions, by and large. Some people still have them. And now they're trying to work up anger amongst working people about these lazy public workers who are destroying our schools and public services by their demands for exorbitant pensions, right? And they're your enemies, not us. We're good guys. We want to give you the wealth you deserve, but it's those lazy workers in the state that's doing this to you. That's an effective, unfortunately, and they tell, of course, young people, Social Security is also dead and dying and it can't last. They'll never get it. So why don't you join with us to develop a wonderful economy where wealth goes down to you as well, instead of winding up in the hands of these lazy elites and workers. That unfortunately, that's been a fairly effective political device. How do we respond to that?
Well, most of my adult life, I've lived in a world where people had that common sense that you just described, that anybody can make it, and we're all future millionaires, and that, you know, there's no need to put programs like Social Security in place. In fact, it's just a drag on the vibrant, dynamic forces of capitalism in America. And I think what's interesting, the financial collapse in 2008 really changed a lot of people's common sense. And the whole idea that we would talk about the 1% and the 99%, that consciousness has evolved quite sharply. And when you look at what's happening politically now, I think, especially for young folks, there's a very strong sentiment that I'm not going to become the next Warren Buffett. I'm not going to make millions. And we need a government and this is especially strong among people under 30, you know, we need a way for our government to provide some floor for everyone in this country. And it's why there's a demand for Medicare for All at the federal level that we've never seen before. And I think, you know, defending Social Security goes hand in hand with that.
And we should be expanding Social Security.
Absolutely.
That's really what should be going on.
Right. And why not do something like that at the state level? There's an initiative in New York State to create essentially a pension system for all New Yorkers. We could do the same thing here in Oregon. Why not expand PERS to include people who work in the private sector? There's no reason we couldn't do it. And I think that it's only a lack of imagination among the political class in Salem that nobody's proposing these kinds of measures to improve the general welfare. And I think, as you said, those of us who are still in unions, who still have pensions, we can't just think defensively because, as you said, if your security in a sea of insecurity, especially when the sea of insecurity is so much bigger and angrier and more desperate than you on your little island of modest security, your future is very grim. The right loves to play crabs in a bucket, you know, like got a little bit. And, you know, the have-nots want to take the people down that have a little. Meanwhile, the people that have it all are just getting away scot-free. So we've got to figure out a way to shine a light on the fact that the people who are, you know, in the top 1% have enormous wealth. The corporations in this state are making enormous profits. And that's not because they're so smart or so ingenious. It's because people like us work so hard to make it possible. And it's time that they actually pay the bill for all of that public investment that made it possible and for all of the work that we've done to make this country, to make this state what it is.
Yeah. You talked about rising of consciousness among the young and about everybody, about the 1% and the 99%. One of the things about this struggle today, though, is that it involves school teachers. There's a 3 million of them, public school teachers, even after they're trying to destroy the public schools and charterize and privatize, of course, for that very reason. Nurses and other health professionals, even, dare I say it, the police, who have expanded greatly, and there's a lot of them out there of many types.
You heard it here first on the old mole.
But in fact, they're also basically public workers or supported by public workers in one way or another, and they have neighbors and family. And political organizations that, although the police political organization is another matter, it seems to me reaching out to police actually makes sense around those economic issues. Certainly the nurses and the school teachers have changed very radically, and they're moving towards social movements, social unionism rather than just business unionism. We have tremendous possibilities.
I think if you look at what's been going on in the country and the world for the last 20 years, it totally is understandable why, if you are a public school teacher, your material conditions, like what it's like in your classroom, is being degraded so tremendously that you are asking yourself the question, well, how do I stop this? You didn't go into teaching to get rich. You didn't become a nurse to get rich. You went in because you wanted to help people, because you wanted to make the world a better place. And you're seeing year in, year out, the thing that you care about, the thing that you do to try and make the world a better place, get degraded. People have had enough, and they're like, we have no choice but to stand up and fight back. I mean, the reasons are very obvious when you start digging into it about why teachers around the country are striking over, you know, funding for education. Why on May 8th there were 25,000 people in downtown Portland? Because everywhere you look, states have been starving the services that that our communities depend on for decades, and we've hit a breaking point. And I think that it's just, at least I'm an eternal optimist, and I look at what's happening now, and I see I'm more optimistic than I've been in my adult life, honestly, about where we could go with this. Because, as you say, you get legions of teachers and nurses and public employees fired up about not just defending, you know, some modicum of basic standards, but actually talking about a vision. We're not talking about defending schools as they are today. We're talking about the schools our students deserve. We're not talking about defending healthcare for profit. We're talking about building a healthcare system for people. Those kinds of things are much more part of the lexicon of union activists and professionals in all of these fields now. And it really raises people's aspirations. They start asking, well, why couldn't we have single-payer health care? Why couldn't we build a health care system that takes care of people in a far more humane and actually efficient and much less costly way? These are questions that people are asking themselves, and they're starting to think about the big answers to those questions. And that's very exciting to me. And I think as long as they keep organizing and keep fighting, we're going to get in more clashes with the 1%, but I think we're going to start winning more of those.
I like your vision, Mark. I'm good at worst-case scenarios, though.
Maybe that's why we're a good team, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Maybe we can do a comedy act. anyway, thanks a lot for talking to us today, Mark.
Absolutely. Always great to be here at KBOO.
Right. So long.
I'm Denise Morris, your host this morning. Later in our program, we'll hear from Desiree Helgers interviewing Ophelia Noble about the Vancouver Police Department's escalating use of lethal force against people of color over the last few months. But next up, we have bookmole Larry Bolden. He reviews the novel The Lowland from Jhumpa Lahiri. Larry?
Good morning. I've been waiting for years for a new book from Jhumpa Lahiri, but somehow missed her latest novel, The Lowland, which was published in 2013. Like her other three books, this is a masterful piece of writing, lyrical and lovely, but telling a very somber story. Two brothers, Subhash and Udayan, I hope I'm not murdering those Indian names, are just 15 months apart, and their bond is incredibly strong. Although Subhash is the older of the two, Udayan is the more daring and much more likely to lead them into mischief. Subhash says, quote, Subhash was uncertain whether he was more frustrated by Udayan's daring or with himself for a lack of it. But he had no sense of himself without Udayan. From his earliest memories, at every point, his brother was there, close quote. Both brothers do well in school and have real talents for math and science, but their primary interest is in revolutionary politics, and especially in the communist parties that battle with one another over whom to follow and which has the truer line. Much of the lowland they live in is covered with water during great parts of the year. Again, quoting from the book, the English started clearing the waterlogged jungle, laying down streets in 1770. Beyond the southern limits of Calcutta, they established a suburb whose first population was more European than Indian, a place where spotted deer roamed and kingfishers darted across the horizon. Close quote. Both brothers are admitted to college and plan to attend graduate school once they graduate. But as it turns out, only Subhash goes on to graduate school in America. Udayan loses interest in continued academic training and remains behind in India, becoming more and more involved in revolutionary politics. The novel jumps back and forth between Rhode Island and India, and as in her early collection of short stories, Lahiri describes in great detail the difficulties in straddling countries and cultures. Neither brother is married, though both expect that eventually their parents will arrange marriages. Udayan begins to see the sister of a student friend, and when she, Gauri, becomes pregnant, they marry and move into his parents' house, a house that his parents keep enlarging so it will accommodate their son's wives and eventual grandchildren. Without telling too much of the story, which Lahiri spins out slowly and patiently, Udayan is eventually killed by the police, and Subhash returns briefly to India. Although Gauri is allowed to stay in the home of her in-laws, they ignore her once Udayan is killed. Subhash wants to get to know his sister-in-law, but his parents discourage any real contact. He buys a shawl for his mother and decides to get one for Gauri as well. Quote, he gave his mother the shawl he'd bought for her. Then he showed her the one for Gauri. I'd like to give her this. You should know better, she said. Stop trying to befriend her. And he's confused by the hostility towards this sister-in-law. He says, you've taken away her colored clothes, the fish and meat from her plate. And the mother responds, these are our customs. Close quote. Eventually, Subhash decides he needs to get Gauri out of the hostile environment of his home, and the only way he can do that is to marry her. Gary is a brilliant student, and although she cares for little once her husband is dead, she still has a powerful urge to learn, and she consents to go back to America as Subhash's wife if they decide that they will simply treat the baby she is carrying as their own. No decision is made as to when or even if the child will ever be told the truth. The remainder of the novel is primarily the story of Gary, Subhash, and their daughter Bella, whom Subhash adores and from whom Bella gets most of her nurturing. Subhash takes Bella for a visit to India, but Gary remains behind, committed to her studies and to teaching philosophy courses. For many and complicated reasons, Gary decides that her husband and daughter are better off without her, and she takes a teaching job across the country in California. While the description of family life, of what counts as love, what counts as loyalty, and what betrayal, is the crowning achievement of the novel, there is so much that Lahiri tells the reader about India, its past, its many wars, and political unrest. As the author notes, very little of this history gets covered in American press, and most of us know very little about the complexity of the country. That's certainly true of this reader. I found this to be a beautiful novel, full of heartaches for sure, but also full of love and commitment. The relationship between Bella and Subhash is wonderfully described, as are the reasons that Gary leaves them. I will remember this book for a long time, and it also led me to two even newer works of hers, a nonfiction autobiographical book, In Other Words, which she wrote in Italian and refused to translate into English, saying that somehow that would dilute the experience of having written it in Italian, though she allows a friend to translate it for her. And another very small book, really an essay, entitled The Clothing of Books, which is really a book about dust jacket designs for hardback books and cover designs for paperbacks, and how little control authors have over such things. I believe Lahiri is one of the finest authors alive, and I recommend all of her work to you. I've been talking in particular about Jhumpa Lahiri's novel, The Lowland. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Larry. Larry Bolden, viewing books for many years on The Old Mole. We always appreciate his take on novels. And our listeners, you know, who listen to The Old Mole often do realize we have a thing for popular culture. It keeps our minds sharp, I think. Well, next, we have Desiree Helliger's interviewing Ophelia Noble, and she's the founder and executive director of Vancouver-based Noble Foundation. They'll be talking about the Vancouver Police Department's escalating use of lethal force against people of color over the last few months. Desiree?
So my guest today is Ophelia Noble, who's the executive director of the Vancouver-based Noble Foundation, and she is also with Southwest Washington Communities United for Change and the Pacific Northwest-wide X Project. So tell us a little bit about what's been going on in Vancouver. I think that police shootings in Portland have been getting significantly more visibility in the region compared to police shootings in Vancouver, but it sounds like there's been a significant escalation in the Vancouver PD's use of lethal force.
Over the last 6 months, we have experienced 4 shootings by Vancouver police officers, and out of those 4 shootings, 3 were people of color, 3 resulted in death, and all 4 were marginalized community members. And there's a lot of concern around our community of color as to the motive of the shootings, the response from police officers, and a lot of frustration.
So the most recent one was a 43-year-old black man named Carlos Hunter?
Carlos Hunter, yes. And prior to Carlos Hunter was Michael Pierce, prior to Michael Pierce was a 16-year-old, Clayton Joseph.
And Clayton had just moved from Micronesia about a year before. He was a high school student.
That is our understanding. Yes, he attended Evergreen High School,
And then there was one other police shooting?
Yes. The first shooting was a result of a police chase along I-5 from Vancouver. Well, it went through Vancouver over into Portland and shut down I-84 in December of 2018.
Our most recent shooting was in March.
Was on March 7th. Carlos Hunter, African-American, shot several times after a police stop in Hazeldale.
So the Columbian did an article on March 10th in which they reported that there had been a total of 28 police shootings in Vancouver in 25 years, 16 of which were lethal shootings. Okay. So in response to the most recent police shooting of Carlos Hunter, the Vancouver police chief, James McElvain, is quoted in a story by OPB from March 11th stating that officers should stay the course. That's the quote, stay the course, that there's nothing particularly disturbing that merits reevaluation.
Yes, that is the statement that he made. Actually, our coalition attended a neighborhood association meeting shortly after this article was released, and there was that same sense of quote-unquote business as usual tone in his responses. What our community is really trying to understand and grapple with is how our police department does not understand how significant four shootings, with three of those shootings being people of color, marginalized community members, is an issue that should be on the top of everyone's radar. It needs to be very special and focused attention. There were three within 3 weeks. Between March 7th, if we count back 3 weeks or 4 weeks, there were three of those four shootings happened within that time span.
There is not any kind of, essentially, there isn't a cop watch organization in Southwest Washington. And so you all are rapidly kind of retooling and organizing to try to address this.
Yes. And I think that speaks to one of the larger concerns that we've experienced in Southwest Washington in general is the lack of progressive activism, the lack of infrastructure support for community-based organizations to be responsive in any way, let alone rapidly respond when situations like this arise. I cannot say in the 30-plus years I've lived in Southwest Washington, specifically Vancouver, that I can remember a season in Vancouver of police shootings as rampant as it felt February and March. We are slowly building the infrastructure to respond to our community concerns.
Do you think that the escalation of police force in Vancouver is connected to the shifting demographics of the community?
Absolutely, absolutely. I believe that the gentrification process of Northeast Portland has really, you know, bolstered our community of color in the Southwest Washington region, which we're seeing, you know, people of color now moving into areas such as Battleground, Ridgefield, Kelso, Longview, due to the ridiculously high housing costs in Vancouver. What we do know is that through some of the work that we have been doing with, like, Evergreen High Schools and the education system, that our students of color population is about 20 to 25%.
Of the Vancouver School District.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Between Vancouver School District and Evergreen School District.
Okay, and it looks like of those 16 lethal shootings, mm-hmm. that all 16 of those lethal shootings have been upheld by an internal police review process as warranted, as justifiable use of force. So that doesn't send a particularly positive message about, you know, the kind of critical nature of internal police reviews in Vancouver. Are there new mechanisms that are emerging for kind of community oversight and investigation of police shootings? Is that part of what you all are pushing for?
Right now, what we are working on is a campaign, Justice for Carlos campaign, as a coalition. The Vancouver Police Department did request an external review of this case, and by external review, they looked at CAMIS to provide that review. We are pushing that a non-connected agency organization come in and review the facts of the case and potentially the findings of the preliminary show of facts that has been completed by the Camas Police Department, which was used to return Sergeant Boyle's it was completed by Sergeant Boyles, but officers Dennis Devlin and Colton Price of the Vancouver Police Department have been cleared to return to work. We're waiting for two remaining reports, which may take up to 6 months to receive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to be clear, I think I said earlier that it was an internal police investigation into the shootings that have determined that they were justifiable use of force, when in fact those shootings, I think, were being reviewed by the prosecutor's office in Vancouver, mm-hmm. which is quite clearly, you know, very closely aligned with the Vancouver PD. And when you're talking about these police shootings being reviewed by, you know, so-called objective agencies that are, you know, in very, very close proximity and engage, you know, together in interagency police trainings, and these departments are all very, very closely aligned. So I think, you know, clearly there are questions about the objectivity of the CAMIS PD evaluating shooting within the Vancouver PD.
Being that we have not had an infrastructure, we are really just trying to be very intentional on the work that we are doing to support the family.
So particularly Southwest Washington Communities United for Change, you've been really involved in turning out community for Vancouver City Council meetings to really bring the concerns of communities of color forward to the City Council. Is this one of the arenas that you're also kind of working on for addressing police shootings?
Yes, absolutely. We began kind of thought bubbling about 5 years ago. What is the infrastructure that we need so our community can have support when they need to stand up, when they need to have their voices heard, when they want to push back against policy? And what we realized is that we really needed a dedicated C4 structure in our community that was led by a person of color. And I want to definitely kind of qualify that in saying that Southwest Washington Communities United for Change is a community-based grassroots organization in juxtaposition to some of the more grass-top organizations. And so 4 years ago, the foundation, with the support of Northwest Health Foundation, really began intentional steps, and we're just now seeing the kind of fruit of that labor coming into community, being able to hold community-based meetings, receive feedback from the community, and allowing the community to lead how this organization responds, reacts, and holds other organizations accountable, our political structures, our social, environmental systems accountable for harms that are happening within communities. So it's a very, it's a relatively new development in Southwest Washington. I think we are at this tipping point where we're recognizing that without social justice, right, without the redistribution of wealth generally and specifically funding and, you know, to move programming forward, a lot of our community-based organizations in Southwest Washington that are led by people of color are not noted, are not known of, and they're just, there's a disconnect between community and leadership, and we're hopeful that SWCUC is able to fill that void.
You know, it does seem as though there's generally a kind of disconnect between Portland and Vancouver with respect to dealing with issues of police violence. I mean, we have a lot of organizing going on this side of the river, but we tend not to see Vancouver police violence as sort of part of this broader picture of a changing region, even when some of this violence is likely being directed at people who are being gentrified out of Portland into Vancouver.
Are there ways
in which our listeners can become involved in this issue and can support the work that you're doing?
Absolutely. I think reaching out to either the Noble Foundation, we do have a website, Facebook page as well, reaching out to Southwest Washington Communities United for Change. We're very visible. We've held a rally. We've held a march in Vancouver. And so the hope is really to not only seek justice for Carlos Hunter, but for all the other victims of the Vancouver police. And in order for that to happen, we need support. We need folks from Portland, you know, coming to Vancouver and providing resources and tools and best practices. And we're a little behind, but I believe we're catching up. So, you know, just reach out to any of us. Carmen McKibben with SWCUC. Email address is swcuc@gmail.com or info@thenoblefoundation.org.
I think there's a tendency to say, recognize that there is a sort of white supremacist troublemakers that people are seeing on this side of the bridge as well. And they're like, you know, send them back to Vancouver, without much of a recognition of the fact that Vancouver has an embattled community of color that is trying to fight back against these dynamics and needs solidarity from Portland activists as well.
That's right.
My guest today has been Ophelia Noble. She's the executive director of the Noble Foundation and also with Southwest Washington Communities United for Change and the X Project. Ophelia, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Desiree. I appreciate the time.
Cyborg, Android, D-Boy, Decoy, Water, Wisdom, Tightrope, Vision, Insight, Stronghold, Heartless, Ice Cold, Mystery, Mastery, Solar.
Some will put a gun because they want to be soft. Snatching up your life into the...
Thank you to Desiree Helligers and Ophelia Noble for that piece. I also want to thank Bill Resnick and Mark Brenner this morning and Larry Bolden, our book mole, for their contributions. Our engineer, Patricia Kohlberg, as always, fantastic job. I'd like to complete the program here with a little something from Howard Zinn, published in the Progressive Media Project in May of 2005. It's about Memorial Day. Howard Zinn, of course, writing a lot over the years about war and the concept of just war, and I feel as though his words are as relevant, if not more, today than ever. This is Howard Zinn. Another Memorial Day, another war. Yes, let's honor those who died in the nation's many wars, but if we don't want to keep adding to the soldiers' graves, let's also ask why they died. We know our political leaders will speak solemnly to the nation with the flags unfurled and the bugles blowing, and they will say, as they always do, they gave their lives for their country. And that is supposed to satisfy the families of the dead, supposed to satisfy all of us whose children and grandchildren may be called upon to serve in future wars. But that sentence, "they gave their lives for their country," contains two falsehoods. First, these young men and women did not give their lives. Their lives were taken from them by politicians who sent them to war and who now bow their heads on Memorial Day. And second, they did not give their lives for their country, but for the government, which right now is President Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, as well as the corporate executives of Halliburton and Bechtel, and all of whom are profiting either financially or politically from the military action that has killed more than 1,600 Americans and continues to kill more every day. No, they did not die for their country because the ordinary people who make up this nation, their families and friends, have received no benefits from the bloodshed in Iraq. The war is not in defense of our country. Iraq did not attack us, nor were we ever in danger of being attacked. Instead, we attacked someone else's country, and as a result, our country is no safer. The war and the military budget are taking $500 billion of the national wealth and spending it on death, while the elements of life, health, education, housing, the care of children and the elderly, even the care of veterans of previous wars are being pushed aside. We are fighting a dishonorable war for which the dishonor belongs on high. If there were justice, we would bring our soldiers home, give them all honorable discharges, and drive out of office with dishonorable discharges the people in and around the White House who have disgraced this country before the world. The memory of the dead deserves a different dedication. No politician who voted for war, no business contractor for the military, no general who looked the other way while torture was taking place, no cabinet member who made excuses for the bombing of civilians should be invited to public ceremonies on this sacred day. Let the dead of all our wars be honored. Let the living pledge themselves never to embark on mass slaughter again. Memorial Day should be a day to put flowers on graves and plant trees, also a day to honor all those striving for peace, including those men and women who have come back from Iraq and called for an end to the war and the occupation. Let us not this Memorial Day, when the traffic in lies will be heavier than ever, set out on the same old reckless drive to death. I'll add to these quotes from Howard Zinn's book, Just War, quote, "We need to expose the motives of our political leaders, point out their connections to corporate power, and show how huge profits are being made out of death and suffering. We must recognize that we cannot depend on the governments of the world to abolish war because they and the economic interests they represent benefit from war." That's Howard Zinn. And this is Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We have Locus Focus coming up next with Barbara Bernstein and plenty more this morning. Of course, you can find us on the web, Old Mole Variety Hour, kbu.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll have this show up on the web there later today. Thank you, Patricia Kohlberg, for your engineering, and we'll be back next week.